Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk. Just a few months ago, a former top National Security Council official under President Trump wrote a powerful piece laying out the case that the Russian government was engaged in what amounted to hybrid warfare against NATO and the West. The ex-official noted that even while it rains missiles on Ukrainian cities, the Kremlin was dramatically escalating attacks across Europe using sabotage, arson, cyber intrusions, and disinformation to undermine Western solidarity and achieve its geopolitical goals. And the official raised a startling idea. Perhaps it is time to officially designate Vladimir Putin's Russia a state sponsor of terrorism. Such a move would, of course, be a major escalation in the shadow war between Washington and Moscow. And this at a time when President Trump is about to once again take office, promising to negotiate a deal with Putin to end the war in Ukraine. We'll talk to the official who wrote that piece, Chris Costa, a veteran of U.S. Army intelligence, who served as NSC Director of Counterterrorism during Trump's first term in office and is now the Executive Director of the International Spy Museum in Washington, all on this episode of Spy Talk. Chris Costa, welcome to Spy Talk.
Hey, Michael, thank you very much for having me.
It's an honor to have you, and there's a lot I want to talk about your recent writings on Russia and where things are going in the new Trump administration, what to expect. You were, of course, a veteran of the first Trump administration. But before we get to that, you've had quite a career in the intel business, 25 years in the U.S. Army in counterintelligence, 2 Bronze Stars for sensitive human intelligence work, and you were inducted into the United States Special Operations Commando Hall of Honor for lifetime service to U.S. Special Operations. Tell us a little about how you got into the intel business and some of the things you did, in particular, what you did to earn getting inducted into the Commando, Special Operations Commando Hall of Honor.
Hey, Michael, again, thank you very much for having me. It truly is a privilege to be able to talk to you about some of the things that we're going to discuss today. So background, I started out as an infantryman, you know, went to airborne school, ranger school, started out in the 101st, was very excited to graduate ranger school and show up at an infantry battalion. And candidly, I loved being an infantryman. I loved our mission statement. It was simple. Life was uncomplicated. And I think I did a fairly good job as an infantry officer, but it wasn't really, you know, answering my calling. And my calling, I thought, was to be an intelligence officer. That's really what I wanted to do. And ultimately, there was an opportunity to transition from the infantry and move into the intelligence field. And I started out a counterintelligence agent. But once I discovered that there was this vast world that I was never going to be exposed to unless I really started advocating for myself, and that was the human world, which was somewhat secretive. trained by other agencies, and I had an opportunity to transition to become an intelligence officer, a counterintelligence agent first, and then subsequently I had an opportunity to be trained in the arcane art of being a human intelligence officer, a case officer. And really, that's where I threw my weight. That's where my passion was. But I did it in special operations. So that's how, after a cumulative experience, multiple deployments, eventually someone recognized some of the past work that I did, and I was surprised to be placed in the Commando Hall of Honor.
Yeah. So you ran ops, you ran counterintelligence ops for the Army. Can you tell us a little about, you know, some of the highlights, to the extent that you can, of the kinds of operations you ran?
So the kinds of operations I ran were very different from a classic human operation where you go ahead and spot, assess, and recruit one individual. In many cases, I was in a position of overseeing networks that countered malign activities in the Middle East. In other words, I oversaw networks of foreigners that were aligned with U.S. interests. And the bottom line is we countered our adversaries on the ground in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Horn of Africa. By overseeing those networks, we were able to enjoy some operational successes, but the majority of that work was classified. But I will say running principal agent networks is very different from dealing with one individual. It is a whole lot easier, in my humble opinion, in my operational experience tells me this, to deal with an individual where you can build a personal relationship with and you have, frankly, direct control. Whereas when you work with networks, sometimes you wind them up and you don't even know who all the sub agents are in that network. You deal with the principal agent. And there's got to be a level of trust there, but it's harder to manage and mitigate risk.
So I was really struck by some of your recent comments and writings about the increasing aggressiveness of Russian intelligence right now. And you did a piece back in June that was pretty striking. I'm just going to read the first couple of graphs here. There's no time to waste. The lights are blinking red again, with NATO countries at greater risk of attacks, this time not by Al-Qaeda or ISIS terrorists, but by Russian-directed agents plotting acts of sabotage and terrorism. NATO recognized the threats across Europe: sabotage, arson, cyber, and disinformation as part of an escalating campaign of hybrid activities. Lay out for us what you see emerging here that is caused you to say the lights are blinking red again.
Yeah, so this isn't hyperbolic in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it's informed by engaging with partners that I've worked with in the past. I've been to Germany, Poland. I have engaged with our Canadian counterparts and former colleagues. And in each case, what I've expressed is my concerns. And certainly I have no access to classified anymore, but they expressed to me, they too are concerned. And again, no hyperbole, right? Think about what's happened just in the last couple days. There was an aircraft that crashed in Vilnius, I believe, in Lithuania. And and some of the articles and the accounts I read went to great pains to say, we are not sure if this was Russian sabotage. Why? Because there have been dry runs by Russia, which would be a significant escalation of testing the possibility of downing aircraft. So this is reported in the open press. There were arsons. There was an there was casing done in Germany. I don't know which U.S. base in Germany, but there was some casing last year done to look at possibly disrupting the supply chain of support for Ukraine. So the idea, stepping back, the idea that Russia would employ covert action, that Russia would employ proxies, that Russia would assassinate, it comes as no surprise to me. Probably many of your listeners will agree that there is a long legacy of Russian covert action, active measures, if you will. And now we are in a time that hybrid warfare, something that was coined a decade or two ago by Frank Hoffman, the idea of hybrid warfare, about employing covert action, employing assassinations, cyber attacks, all as part of the tools that Russia would use, is not at all surprising. So none of this is exaggeration. It is very concerning. The head of MI6, Secret Intelligence Service in the UK, has publicly talked about this, and so hasn't the head of MI5. So I think it is something that is very, very concerning.
Let me just ask you, like, you talk about Russian hybrid warfare using, you know, the tools of the old KGB and you know, we're seeing it across Europe right now. Does this form of hybrid warfare, in your view, trigger Article 5 for NATO that requires a military response?
No, you're exactly right. That's the right question to ask, Michael. Does it trigger Article 5 being invoked, the idea that the Russians bring down an aircraft? I would argue, yes. I'm not an attorney, but NATO has to start walking through what are the triggers for an escalation where all NATO alliance members would then galvanize to counter Russia or to attack Russia. Essentially, that would be an act of war. These questions have been kicking around for some time. I would ask another question, you know, coming from a counterterrorism background, you know, is this, do these activities in general, do they smack of state-sponsored terrorism from Russia, the idea of politically motivated assassinations, even killing Prigozhin, or presumably the Russians killing Prigozhin, head of a proxy organization for Russia, when the aircraft crashed under mysterious circumstances. Really no mysterious circumstances. We understand that that aircraft was brought down deliberately, whether there's evidence available to the public or not. That's politically motivated. That is a state bringing down an aircraft to kill somebody that was an enemy of the state.
So can I just point out, you wrote your piece in which you floated the idea of designating Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism back in June. And just this month, The Wall Street Journal reported this: European security officials have linked suspected Russian operatives to a plot to smuggle incendiary devices onto a cargo plane in Germany, in what investigators believe may have been a trial run for future attacks targeting North America-bound aircraft. That is the very definition of terrorism, right? But to take such a dramatic step as labeling, I think we only label four countries right now in the world as state sponsors of terrorism. And, you know, the list does look pretty political. You know, Cuba is still on there, you know, as is Syria and North Korea. But, I mean, were the United States to go that route, it would be a dramatic escalation in our conflict with the Russians.
It absolutely would be an escalation, and that's something that has to be factored into any decisions. I think some of this, Michael, and this is a little beyond the scope of you know, the work that I do, but clearly the United States has to assess the possibility for de-escalation. A new administration is coming in. There are overtures that there are possibilities that there could be some de-escalation, that we could stand down from this, from these threats. Everything from nuclear to chemical threats have been out there for the last 3 years of this conflict, or almost 3 years of the conflict. So there is possibility of some kind of ceasefire agreements, I think.
Well, I was just going to, but the path you're advocating would certainly make that more difficult, right? I mean, if we were to really step up and declare Russia Putin's Russia a terrorist state, wouldn't that tie the hands of a new president trying to negotiate a deal with Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you go back and look at the article, I don't frankly advocate for that directly. What I do is say it needs to be considered. And I actually cite somebody else's argument on that. I agree. It is something that we have to look at. In labeling, I think I point out, can be counterproductive. And that's the heart of your comment. So at the end of the day, what it really gives you is leverage for negotiation and a consideration. You know, is Russia a state sponsor of terrorism? And the idea that the United States would consider that may give us, the United States, some leverage for diplomatic negotiations. And it would all be about deterring a wider war, deterring and preventing an escalation. So I think everything has to be on the table to include that.
Yeah. I should point out, by the way, you mentioned the plane crash, the DHL plane crash in Lithuania this week, just today. And I understand why there was a lot of suspicion about that, particularly in light of what the Wall Street Journal had reported. But I should point out that the Lithuanian government today said it has found no sign that the crash of the DHL plane was caused by sabotage, and they believe technical issues were a more likely explanation. So obviously we have to be on guard for signs of what the Russians are up to, but it doesn't mean every bad thing that happens in the world can be linked to them. But let's talk about Ukraine right now, because obviously that's the big one. President Biden, just in the last few days, has authorized the use of Army tactical missile systems for the Ukrainians to strike deep into Russian territory. I think the range is up to 190 miles. He's also authorized landmines for the Ukrainians to use to stop Russian incursions. Both of these are escalating steps. And of course, you know, the Kremlin has responded. It said it's updating or modifying its nuclear doctrines, so raising once again the prospect of a nuclear conflict there. Lay out what you see as a path to a negotiated settlement, and does it require accepting the reality on the ground that the Russians got Donbas and Crimea, and there's no strategic path at the moment to dislodge them from those territorial gains?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is a significant escalation. It's negotiate, fight hard, negotiate. I think it's a principle that has been used throughout history. In other words, the escalation is posturing for the potential for a negotiation, because regardless of who the president is coming on board, there's a honeymoon period for a new president, if it's a new president and not the same administration. Clearly, it's not President Biden, it's President Trump. As such, that honeymoon period is an opportunity of uncertainty, where I think the president enjoys some space for negotiation. It gives Ukraine some space, and it gives the Russians some space. It's an open question. What is Zelensky willing to give up? And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, what's the deal that you would foresee as a possible end to this war?
I think a frozen conflict, a stasis that exists sometime in the future. It's sort of a new, it wouldn't be a Berlin Wall, to be sure, but some kind of, figurative wall that is between Russian speaking Ukrainians and in the terrain that's already been seized by Russia and the Ukraine. So there's going to be a frozen conflict. There's going to be a tit for tat. There'll still be some level of unconventional warfare or guerrilla warfare. But I think that there might be overall ceasefire, meaning rockets and attackums aren't used against Russian cities and vice versa. There aren't swarming attacks by Russia into Ukraine. I think that's the best possible outcome. I think that Ukraine stands to lose some terrain, but I can't answer whether that's tenable to the Ukrainians or not.
And if such a deal were in fact struck, do you think the Putin and the Russians would stand down from the kind of aggressive espionage and paramilitary activities they've been engaged in across Europe?
Yeah, I think that Russia may tamp down some of their work, but since 2019, it's been reported that Russian military intelligence, their GRU, has an assassination unit. They've been very active. We already talked about the concerns regarding hybrid warfare. So in many cases, covert action, active measures are a substitute for large-scale shooting wars. So I see some of that abating, but not all of it, because a country, a state like Russia, hasn't achieved some of its broader objectives, which are what? To counter NATO, to regain some of the territory it lost with, their view, Putin's view, the devastating evolution of NATO, the expansion of NATO. So all of these things will be factored into, Russia's three-dimensional chess that it wants to play. And what's an open question is, how is the incoming administration going to deal with Russia and some of these threats?
Well, a good time for us to take a quick break, because when we come back, you worked for President Trump, his first tour of office at his National Security Council. So I want to explore how you see the new Trump administration shaping up and how you think it will handle some of these issues. So let's take a quick break and we will come right back. We are back with Chris Costa, who, as I mentioned in the introduction, but not so far in the course of our conversation, is also now the executive director of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Put that on your list for your next tourist trip to Washington, if you live outside. Chris, you worked at the NSC under President Trump. When he first took office, you were director of counterterrorism, and you had a chance to see how he handles issues relating to Russia and, other malign actors around the world. Give us your sense of how he is likely to focus in his new administration.
Yeah, appreciate the question. So I would answer that within the scope of, my expertise, my background, and what I saw in terms of counterterrorism. And what I saw in terms of counterterrorism in 2016 during the transition team to Inauguration Day in January 2017, the threat landscape has changed dramatically from a counterterrorism standpoint. I never had any interactions on the Russian front, quite candidly, because we were so engaged on the ISIS threat. And I've been reminding people for the last 8 years that our focus on day one, literally on inauguration day, was really fourfold, right? We were worried about a pervasive threat to commercial aviation. Our adversaries wanted to bring down aircraft. I'm talking about terrorist organizations. Secondly, we had to accelerate the Defeat ISIS campaign. We wanted to take away the physical caliphate from ISIS. Thirdly, we had to make a decision to conduct a counterterrorism operation or not do it in the Arabian Peninsula against Al-Qaeda, which was subsequently executed. And last, we had hostages that were held by terrorists from Africa to Pakistan. So it was a dizzying amount of threats that we were dealing with. And from my optic, and I'm not entirely objective, but I think the professional team that I had to work with from the interagency, informed by excellent intelligence, I think we prosecuted well on all fronts as it related to counterterrorism. And I got support from the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, and the Homeland Security Advisor, Mr. Tom Bossert, to really execute on all those fronts. So from a CT standpoint, I was very pleased with the trajectory. But if you flash forward, Michael, to where we are now, ISIS has metastasized. We have less eyes on the ground, so to speak, in Africa. ISIS is growing there. ISIS is not defeated completely. We knew it never would be. But ISIS-K has enjoyed a bit of a renaissance, right? Khorasan group coming out of Afghanistan. So it's a very different landscape in 2024 that the Trump administration is handling from a CT standpoint.
Let me ask you, because you mentioned like one of your principal, principal focus was going after ISIS and destroying the caliphate state. One of Trump's more controversial nominations is Tulsi Gabbard to be Director of National Intelligence. In 2017, while you were working on defeating ISIS at the NSC, she made a trip to Syria to meet with Assad, which I recently wrote about. Of course, Syria, of course, is one of the four state sponsors of terrorism that the United States designates. And during that trip, she adopted Assad's line on the Syria conflict. There are no moderate rebels. All the rebels fighting Assad were Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and ISIS, who were being supported by the United States. That's what Tulsi Gabbard said in 2017. She also praised Syria in a blog posting as a secular, a pluralistic, free society. Of course, it's one of the most brutal totalitarian regimes in the world. Were you aware of Gabbard's trips to Syria at the time? And what do you make of her nomination, a nominee to be Director of National Intelligence, saying things that I assume you believe are completely at variance with the facts?
Yeah, so I don't know Gabbard. I've never met her. I've seen the reports on her purported relationship with, or comments rather, on Syria. And I can offer this. I was in the Trump administration when President Trump made the decision to fire cruise missiles, I believe, at Syria because they use chemical weapons on their own people. So from a policy standpoint, certainly warming up to Syria was a counter to what we were trying to achieve at the time. But when that visit took place, or reportedly took place, I had no visibility over it whatsoever. But I will say that Syria is a malign regime. I think that at the time, what I was watching very closely was the fact that Syria was holding potentially U.S. hostages still, and they didn't acknowledge holding those hostages. I believe President Biden called out very, very forcefully called out Assad for holding Austin Tice hostage. They're no friend of that regime, is no friend of the United States. With respect to her selection, we will see, or nomination, we'll see what happens during the confirmation process. But my hope is, if she is confirmed, that the intelligence community, all 18 members of that intelligence community, will continue to educate her, and she will be well informed by sensitive intelligence, and she'll come to understand what her crucial role is as the Director of National Intelligence.
Are you troubled by her nomination?
I don't even know how to answer that, to tell you the truth. I stay out of the politics. She has been nominated. I want to see the confirmation process, and I would probably judge Tulsi Gabbard after watching the confirmation play out. I would have a point of view. Right now, it would be premature for me to even offer an opinion on it.
Another move that has been announced is the guy who's going to take over what I believe is your old job, NSC counterterrorism, and it is another somewhat controversial figure, Sebastian Gorka, who was at the NSC while you were there. Did you cross paths with him, and what do you make of the fact that he's designated to take your old job?
Well, first of all, For the nation's sake, I wish Sebastian Gorka and his team nothing but the best, right? It's for the United States. It's for our foreign partners. I would just make the point that I truly would want Sebastian Gorka to go back and evaluate the trajectory of the threat since 2017 and look at how my team and the subsequent counterterrorism teams at the NSC operated, because CT has always had, counterterrorism has always had a reputation, candidly, for being apolitical and avoiding politicization in any way, shape, or form. So I would urge anybody in that position to avoid politicization, to ensure that the counterterrorism security group, which is essentially the body at the NSC that comes together, that process continues. It is integral to keeping the nation safe, and that will also infuse a sense of confidence with our foreign partners. So in other words, I think the work even of my predecessors in the Obama administration, that work, our subsequent work, and later work during the Trump administration is a good template with respect to counterterrorism for Sebastian Gorka to consider as he figures out how he is going to leave his mark with his team on counterterrorism. I would also urge everyone, to include your listeners, go back and look at the 2018 National Counterterrorism Strategy. The most critical comments about that strategy during the Trump administration was the idea that it wasn't remarkable in terms of, you know, it's, you know, being very Trumpian. It was very, very grounded and very very thoughtful based on the threat. And a lot of criticism said this couldn't have been, you know, part of President Trump's administration, he wouldn't have had his fingerprints on it. Well, he did, because ultimately he signed the 2018 counterterrorism strategy and the national security strategy that was published before 2018. So it was very well grounded, and it was well informed by intelligence and professionals that weighed in on all the weighty debates that played out during that first year. So I think Gorka needs to go back and make sure he assesses the work that's been done since 2017.
Do you think he's capable of taking politics out of it and focusing, as you did, on the actual threat intelligence?
I think to answer your question, I think he is capable of doing that. I think once someone jumps in with both feet, starts seeing the intelligence, starts being well informed by this this community that has been so focused on counterterrorism, you can't help but to be influenced by the professionals. And at the end of the day, my mantra was, listen, to my team, I would say, take a deep breath. I am the one that has to make a recommendation. So if you see, if our team saw some or read some account about an intention from the administration or from the West Wing that we didn't like as counterterrorism professionals, our job was to just lay out the options and what the causes and consequences and the effects of decisions are. We are not to place a value judgment on it. We're to give the President of the United States options and tell him what the consequences of those options are. And it has to be done as dispassionately and take the emotion out of it. My job was to go over and present that to the National Security Advisor, the Homeland Security Advisor, and potentially the President of the United States, and to do that unflinchingly.
To wrap up here, you've mentioned the 2018 counterterrorism strategy that you helped formulate, but you've also said that the threat landscape has changed dramatically since then. So if you were to go back into your old job or into the administration, how would you want to update what you worked on back then in 2018? And, you know, as at least as part of that, what do you see as the principal terrorism threat right now that the country has to worry about?
That's a terrific question. And the bottom line is, I think the counterterrorism community is still trying to reconcile the consequences of October 7th on galvanizing a whole suite of would-be terrorists. I think the radicalization process has changed. There are pockets of people that are being radicalized online. And there's a grab bag of grievances, Michael. And what's unclear is, you know, how are those threats going to manifest? I've already talked about ISIS-K. We have to hold Afghanistan accountable. I'm talking about the Taliban, to put pressure on ISIS Khorasan group. We still have to hold people in the Taliban responsible for hostage taking, like the Minister of Interior. So at the end of the day, we also have to relook at the possibility of deployments of small-sized special operators in places in the world where we no longer have a footprint. And we have to continue to work with our foreign partners, because there are places the United States is no longer operating. But to the point of principles, I think counterterrorism pressure works. It works on applying pressure on Iran. They can't continue to be the supplier for this so-called, in quotes, access of resistance. They have to be held accountable. So maximum pressure means sanctions, possibly negotiations. But at the end of the day, It is unacceptable that Iran continues to arm and foment problems against U.S. partners in the Middle East. I mean, there's been a shadow war that's been ongoing for decades, and that shadow war has now amped up to a mid-level conflict. Fortunately, there's a ceasefire that broke out just today in Lebanon. With Hezbollah and Israel, hopefully there can be some kind of peace negotiation and ceasefires in Gaza to bring home Israeli and American hostages.
We still have 5 American hostages.
That's right.
Being held in Gaza. Wrap up question here, but is that grounds for U.S. Special Forces going in to try to find those hostages?
Look, because it's in Israel's sphere of influence, I think, providing advice and support, meaning intelligence, and that's been widely reported in the open media. That is very logical to plug into fusion cells to offer assistance. But at the end of the day, if there's going to be a rescue attempt in Gaza, it is likely going to be executed by Israel. They know the terrain. It's their sphere of influence. And so far, we've seen some of that play out.
Yeah, we shall see. Chris Costa, we could go on. There's so much here to talk about. I love your references to the shadow war, which I believe is something that visitors to the Spy Museum can learn a lot about, at least the history of shadow wars between U.S. intelligence and its adversaries. Thanks a lot, and hope to have you back.
Michael, thank you very much. Have a wonderful holiday, and I hope we can do this again. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.